The dreaded so. What one day of practice, one whole day of sitting and walking and for some of you, it might have been a long day. You know. One of the things I wanted to express is my appreciation for you, you know, especially those of you who are new to this, to these meditation retreats, but to all of you. Your appreciation and respect what you're doing, your effort. And it's not easy. I know it's not easy. And I take a lot of comfort, you know, and I hope maybe you will, in this idea that a moment of mindfulness is never wasted. You know, I think very early on in my practice, I heard Gil talking about this, some of you have probably heard this, drip by drip, the bucket is filled, you know, and this idea that a moment of being present, a moment of being awake, has its own value, and and the other thing to say is just how difficult it can be. You know, right now we can say we're in the heart of the retreat, you know. And how difficult it can be when you're in the retreat, when you're in the middle of it, to objectively evaluate it. So however you think you're doing, or however you think it's going, it might be good to just hold that lightly. Retreats often have this way of reverberating and revealing themselves in our life slowly. So, you know, not to be at all sure that that you know what's what's going on here. And so one of the ways of understanding this path, this practice, is that it's this process of becoming ourselves. It's this process of more and more growing into who we already are, what's already there. I was visiting with a teacher of mine, a Zen teacher, the other day, and he said, oh, such and such of his students just gave a talk. And I said, oh, how was the talk? And he said, it was really good. And then my ears perked up, and I said, oh, you know, what was good about it? How, you know, how was it good? What makes you say it was good? And he said, it was really good because she was really herself. You know. And I thought, oh yeah, be yourself. But and so in a way we can think of this practice as giving us a chance to experience an unedited version of ourselves. You know, in so many other dimensions of life, you know, we're in roles. And it's, you know, it's appropriate. And we put on this hat and we do this, and we put on this hat and we do this. And, you know, we're a different person for you know, our mother versus our friend versus our child, you know. It brings forth different aspects of who we are. And then in the meditation, It's like this totally free realm where, you know, we take the shape of sitting or walking, and we come into this container retreat center. But in the meditation itself, we get the chance to experience, in the first draft of who we are. And there's a reason why we don't show first drafts to people. You know, first drafts are messy. First drafts have a lot of, you know, just everything. And just this engaging in this endeavor, for one thing, it shows us how difficult it is, how difficult it actually is to simply experience ourselves this way. I think of this, I can't remember where I saw it, but it was, I think it was, it must have been an artist, like a performance artist or something, who put a camera behind a mirror. It was like a two-way mirror, maybe, and he put a camera behind it. And so the camera recorded how everybody looked, basically, how everybody looked at themselves, you know. And it was great. It was so fun to watch. And it was so familiar. Because it's hard to just look at ourselves. We're so used to kind of, you know, just turn a little bit because that's a little better angle, or, you know, as a, you know, this kind of, as a touch-up mirror or something. So, anyway, that's one way of understanding the meditation. It's that we get to experience ourselves, to fully experience what's there without trying to change it. And we get to see what gets in the way of this and what makes it difficult. So there was a monk in the time of the Buddha who was a very respected kind of, teacher himself and kind of venerated. And but he started to doubt what he was doing, and he wasn't in the Buddhist scene, in the Dharma scene, practicing another practice, but he had some kind of doubt and some kind of insight that there was another way of practicing that would bring him to full liberation, to full freedom. And he, various ways of talking to people, someone said, he said, who is the greatest spiritual teacher? Who is, you know, who can teach me the truth? Who can teach me how to practice? And he was eventually directed to the Buddha. And so this monk or this practitioner, his name was Bhāhiya. You might have heard this name before. And so he tracked the Buddha down with a lot of urgency. By now, his spiritual problem, his spiritual question was really growing inside him. So he found the Buddha, he tracked him down, and basically went up to him and said, let's see, what did he say? Lord, teach me the Dhamma, teach me the truth, O Blessed One. Teach me the Dharma, O Holy One, so that it will be for my long-term welfare and bliss. And, you know, what do you think, you know, the Buddha, this great spiritual master, what did he say? He said, not now. He said, this is not the time, Bhāhiya. I'm busy. I'm going into town, and we're doing our alms round. We're begging for food. But for a second time, Bahia pleaded with the Buddha. But Holy One, it is hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Buddha's life, or what dangers there may be for mine. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. You might die, I might die. You know, the spiritual urgency. Please teach me the Dhamma, Blessed One, so that I may be happy and free. So, okay, this is a pretty heartfelt plea, right? And again, the Buddha said no. He said, this is not the right time, Bahia. No, we're doing something else right now. If you know these stories, you know kind of how this goes. I think the Buddha can never refuse a third time. And for a third time, Bahia pleaded his case with urgency, again citing the uncertainty of the future and begging to be taught the Dhamma, that it would free him from his suffering. So this time, the Buddha relented. And the Buddha gave the following teaching. He said, Bahia, you should train yourself like this. Whenever you see something, simply see it. Whenever you hear something, simply hear it. Whenever you taste something, simply taste it. When you smell something, simply smell it. When you feel something, simply feel it. Whenever a thought arises, let it just be a thought. Then you will not exist. Whenever you do not exist, you will not be found in this world, another world, or in between. Just this is the end of suffering. So, we like the sutta in this tradition. It kind of it points to this uncomplicated way of being, you know, this possibility. I mean, one of the ways I like to think about it is that meditation leaves everything exactly as it is. It leaves everything exactly as it found it, you know. Nothing is different except us, except we've somehow dissolved into the experience. And for me, what this brings up is this appealing, this tantalizing and mysterious proposition that all the particulars of our life, you know, whether they're wonderful, whether they're experienced as being wonderful or experienced as being difficult, are actually not a problem. You know, they're not in themselves a problem. So it points to something about the relationship, how we relate to our life. You know, and it's in the relationship, and only in the relationship, you could say, is where practices, where meditation is, and where freedom is. One of the ways of understanding practice that has been so helpful for me is just this simple way of looking at experience, that it can be divided in two ways. In any moment, there's simply what's happening on the one hand, and then how am I relating to what's happening? What's the relationship? And as you've probably seen from just, you know, from just the experience of being here today and practicing, we don't really have that much control over the first thing of what's happening. You know, we have some control, but where we focus and where can find peace and find freedom is in this relating part, how we relate. So you might hear this word clinging a lot in, you know, in the interviews and talks and instructions, and this is what the Buddha awoke to. This very simple dynamic that when we cling, when we hold on and grasp and desire or push away, resist a fear, this clinging creates suffering. And so the proposition of this practice is that it's possible to live a life of non-clinging. It's possible to live a life that is free, has a kind of inner freedom. It doesn't mean difficult things don't happen. It doesn't mean unpleasant things don't happen. It doesn't mean wonderful things and pleasant things don't happen. But this movement of the mind to get caught up and hooked on things, it's possible to understand that and see it so clearly and release it. You know, so. I mean, another way that I think about practice or the path of practice is we're somehow discovering a way to disentangle, disentangle our mind from all the changing conditions, you know, of our life. And so usually the mind is very caught up and very, you know, we're just so the mind of non-clinging is pointing to a kind of disentangling or independence. The mind becomes independent. You might know that line from the Satipatthana Sutta, to dwell independently. You know, so this is a pretty different concept of freedom than our, you know, in some, you know, maybe our way. Usually, I think, especially in this culture, often to be free is to be free to do whatever I want, right? Is to be free to just, act out my fulfill my desires, basically. And so, you know, and just so even, you know, just what does it mean to be free in this other sense? What does it mean to be free, to not caught by, not controlled by, not compelled by just the changing things that happen, you know, in your life? So, and I would suggest that we can get a taste of this freedom in every sitting, in every walking. You know, it's like when we resist the impulse to, whether it's indulge that fantasy, or shift, or scratch, or, you know, when there's just this observing power of the mind, it's like that can be a moment of freedom. You know, even though there's discomfort or something unpleasant, we can hold it. We can experience it, and we're independent of it. So I mean, I think we've all had that experience. And then this idea to know something, in the way you're just defining, you know, to know something or to see something, is to be free of it. Precisely because I think Inez talked about this, that in a moment of mindfulness, you know, a moment of being mindful of anger, the mind is free of anger. You know, the part of the mind that knows anger is itself not angry. You know, awareness doesn't get angry. Awareness doesn't get harmed or diminished, or so this is the part of our being, of our mind, that we call forth in mindfulness practice. And I mean, does that make sense? I mean, that's such a, you know, when you really get that, and you can, you know, it's this wonderful feeling, because what you discover is that it's possible to be mindful of anything, you know, and this can sometimes come as an insight in the practice, that no matter what happens to me, there's a part of me that can see it, that can know it. And that part itself is free, is independent of what's happening. And that's really good news, you know, because there's all kinds of things, as we know, that happen to a human being in a human life. And so to have this ally, to have this freedom is a wonderful thing. And the other reason why it's good news is that maybe, just maybe, it's pointing to a kind of happiness that is not about lining up all the conditions of our life to be just right. You know, when only I have the perfect or good enough, you know, job, career, partner, family, house, whatever. That's still in the world of conditions. And, you know, there's a certain, to be sure, importance and wisdom to knowing how to navigate conditions. But I think it's really good to know that conditions don't have to be perfect for us to be happy. And that's basically what this is saying. So in a way, we can say that the heart of the practice is just this very simple question. In any moment, is there clinging or is there not clinging? You know, what's the relationship? And in our sitting, this is often expressed as, the way that's been so helpful for me is just asking the question, is there some sense of struggle in the practice? Any sign of struggle, any sense of struggle, whether it's physical or mental, is a sign that something is, something is not being opened to, something is not being accepted. So it's just this very simple question. And it brings up another question. What is it like to be not in conflict? To be not contentious, to be and not in conflict with what's arising. So when looking at this question of clinging, in the question of non-clinging, we start to become interested in all the ways we cling, all the ways we grasp, hold on, push away. And then according to this teaching, there is a very important moment in our experience that sets this whole chain in motion. If you've heard of this chain of suffering, from contact to feeling to clinging to suffering. The key moment or the pivotal moment is said to be the experience of pleasant or unpleasant. So in a way it's almost so simple that it's like really? Like everything comes from the experience of pleasant or unpleasant. Basically, yeah. I mean, it's so it's said that in every conscious moment is registered, is experienced as either being one of three things: pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Neither pleasant or unpleasant. And then from this, it's pleasant, I like it, I want it. It's unpleasant, I don't like it, I don't want it, or I hate it. I put this out as more of an invitation than something to kind of believe or, it's like, it's suggesting that there's a tremendous value in getting to the root of our likes and dislikes, the roots of our craving and our aversion. And the value is that when we can see and be with what's pleasant, what's simply pleasant and unpleasant, we have some choice, and we don't have to necessarily go down this path of suffering. In a way, it runs so counter to how our minds operate. I have two daughters who are 3 and 1. And especially the one-year-old, it's, if you've heard of like a a heat-seeking missile, She's like a pleasure-seeking missile. She just will look in a room for what's interesting, what's, you know, what in her. I mean, she'll find the one thing we don't want her to touch. You know, like it's just within reach. If she, we're holding her, you know, in the back. She's like, how did you get that? You know, and if she's upset, if she's crying, the best way to get her to stop crying is to just find something, some little morsel of delicious, you know, some whatever, cracker, something, and just pop it in her mouth. And then immediately, unpleasant is replaced with pleasant. And she's just like, I've been waiting for that. My fix of pleasant, you know. And it's so amazing to watch, you know, to just watch, you know, we didn't teach her this. It's like, it's so, so much a part of our conditioning. And we'd like to think that as we become adults, you know, totally different. But it's interesting. I mean, you know, so something you can watch, you know, what is my relationship to pleasant sensation? What is my relationship to unpleasant sensation? Some of us or some people have a, you know, strong orientation towards just things should be pleasant. You know, it's a mistake if something is unpleasant. Or something's wrong, or something's wrong with me if it's unpleasant. I notice that for myself, and just, you know, thinking about a long drive I have to make, and I was thinking, not consciously, it was just like, how can I make that a little more pleasant, you know? Well, I could have a cup of coffee, or I could listen to something. It was just, you know, it's the mind was just anticipating something that might be unpleasant. So how can I make it more pleasant? So then this, the neutral, this neither pleasant nor unpleasant, that's said to condition confusion. You know, we tend not to notice the neutral moments. So pleasant moments condition enjoyment and desire, unpleasant moments aversion and irritation, and neutral boredom and confusion. And so this idea that all of our clinging has its root in the pleasant and unpleasant experience. It's a pretty radical idea in a way, and it's kind of an insulting idea. You know, it's like all of my sophisticated clinging is just, you know, has to, you know, we're kind of just like moths going to the light or something. One of the ways this was brought home to me when I was doing a meditation retreat at IMS, and one of the teachers, Joseph, was talking about a time in his practice when he was struggling with desire, and really working with desire, and, you know, lust or desire, and these things. And he was just talking about how he was working with it, but in a kind of offhand way, he would say, it would just come up again and again, you know, just in images. And he would just note, pleasant, pleasant, pleasant. And in that moment, I thought, oh, that's how you work with it. I mean, that's, you know, I had thought this teaching was so, you know, so kind of dry or kind of, you know, like a little insulting or a little reductionist or a little, but oh, there's a way of, I don't know, something about that really brought it home to me, that to notice the pleasantness of something, to know when something really has a pull to us, and to hang out there, to hang out at the level of pleasant. In the same way, you know, we've talked about this, I feel like we've talked about this a lot in the practice discussions, but the value of practicing with what's unpleasant. You know, we don't seek the unpleasant, we don't particularly want the unpleasant or like it, but For a meditator, there's a tremendous value in being with, learning how to be not in conflict with what's unpleasant. You know, difficult emotions can come up, difficult memories from the past, or it could be something, you know, just when you have 40, 50 people in a room, there may be someone or something that irritates you, that's unpleasant. And so to be able to have the capacity to be with it, to hold it, to not be in conflict with it, to be independent of it, is a tremendously valuable skill. And so this question, so how do we relate to the pleasant and unpleasant? And then another question that I think is I find very interesting is the quality of pleasant and unpleasant, where does that reside? Is it out there? You know, is it in the object? Is it inherent in the experience? Or is it in us? You know, is it in the mind? And so there's another something to explore. I think we could all probably agree that there's at least a big subjective element to this. You know, if you hear the sound of the bell, the same sound, is it pleasant or is it unpleasant or is it neither? If you're sitting and your knees are aching, like you probably are, and you're you know, ready for the bell to ring, that might be experienced as a very pleasant sound. You know, if you're taking an exam and you have all these questions to do and running out of time, and then you think it's like, you know, might be experienced as unpleasant. So just understanding this, that the experience of pleasant and unpleasant is a mental event, you know, is something that's happening in the mind, how we're experiencing. And it's often can be situational, it can be depend on the context. You know, so as I said before, this clinging comes from not seeing this pleasant and unpleasant. So the primary way of working with it is simply to tune in, you know, to this level of our experience. So it's said to know the feeling of pleasant or unpleasant or neither when it arises, and to be clear, this is pleasant or this is unpleasant or this is neither. You know, you can see if that's true for you, but it traditionally it's said that it has to be one of those. So to be clear, which one is it? Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neither? And then, so to know the feeling when it arises. And then, so, you know, and this is the tricky part, is it possible to stop there? Is it possible to stop at the level of pleasant, unpleasant? You know, usually a picture of someone we don't like comes up in the mind. It's like a coworker or someone, you know, And then it's a story. And then that triggers an emotion. How could she say that to me? Blah, blah, blah. And then you start to get a little bit annoyed. And then, you know, so all these things start happening. So is it possible when that image comes up of that person, just, you know, just hang out? Oh, it's unpleasant. Don't tell her or him. And so doing this practice and getting, you know, I mean, it's just a kind of familiar, you know, it's just the skill of noticing this, builds the mindfulness, builds the equanimity that allows us to be less reactive. So knowing it when it arises, and then staying with the pleasant feeling, or staying with the unpleasant feeling, or staying with the neutral feeling until it ends. And this is where that this pleasant and unpleasant practice becomes a vehicle for insight. Because pleasant is impermanent. Unpleasant is impermanent. Neither pleasant nor unpleasant is impermanent. So the greatest value to this is seeing the impermanent nature of the pleasant feeling, of seeing the impermanent nature of the unpleasant feeling. And it's almost like we just, I mean, if you get into this practice, and it's, I will admit, it's probably not the most popular practice. But if you get into this practice, it's quite amazing how you just, we just ricochet between pleasant and pleasant. I think for many of us, there's this unconscious strategy, it might be conscious at times, of it's like the way to be happy is to maximize moments of pleasant experience. If you can just minimize the unpleasant and maximize the pleasant, you know, that'll do it. And so this is challenging, this assumption or this strategy. And taking into account impermanence, we know that even pleasant sensation, pleasant feeling, has a built-in unpleasantness to it. Because when something pleasant ends, that's experienced as unpleasant. Mm-hmm. So even if we go for the pleasant, and we try to get the pleasant, we're just caught in this constant thing, because every pleasant experience ends, and then it's unpleasant. Then we look for the next pleasant, and then it ends, and we look for the next. So, so it's pointing to this, to another way of to clearly see these, to clearly know these feelings, and in that knowing, there's freedom, you know, and then we have some choice. Okay, do I follow this or no? Or is it going to be helpful to spin out and, you know, in aversion and anger or judgment or something, or no, it's just unpleasant. It's just you know, so we can come to some kind of ease about, you know, whether the external world is pleasant or unpleasant. One interesting thing just to say about meditation is that as the meditation deepens, pleasant experience becomes very important. And the way in to more settledness, more calm, more concentration is said to be through pleasant vedana, through pleasant sensation. So, you know, that sense of ease, that sense of well-being, that can come from within. That's not dependent on external objects, but that can come from within is not only very nourishing, but is a very important part of the path. So, you know, it's not at all saying that pleasant is bad or pleasant is wrong. It's these are the components of our life, of our experience. But just to have the skill to see them for what they are brings a kind of freedom. So just to say a little bit more about our friend Bahia, who was, if you remember him, he was, this urgent question came to the Buddha. The Buddha said, in the seeing, just see. In the feeling, just feel. So with this instruction, Bahia was awakened. And, in the moment of hearing this brief explanation of the Dharma from the Buddha, Bahia was immediately released from all forms of suffering generated by clinging, desiring, aversion, and ignorance. The Buddha then went on his way. The story has a little bit of two minds, so the story has a little bit of a bittersweet ending, because the Buddha goes off on his way, and then a few moments later, Bahia is attacked by a cow, and he dies. So. And but he had solved his problem. His mind was freed. And in this way, the Buddha said to the other monks, we will make a monument here to Bahia, who was a noble one, a companion. And, you know, it was good that he was persistent, because so fortunately for us, we don't have any wild cows, as far as I know, the property. So, however it is for you, you know, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, whether there's strong desire in the mind or strong aversion, whether there's joy and delight and wonder, or fear and frustration and it's all in the mix, and we're all going to cycle through all of these. So just to clearly know it, to clearly see it right where it is where we can find our freedom. Thank you very much for your attention. And I hope that as you feel into whatever your question is, you know, Bahia had his question, but whatever your question is, that you have the similar passion and urgency and determination to hold that question and find your answers. So, thank you very much.